Welcome to the Next M Podcast. Tech at heart, ignition in mind.
Welcome. Here is the Next M Podcast. My name is Lars Peters, and I have Professor Charles Spence with me. He is experimental psychologist at the University of Oxford and a
gastrophysicist.
What does a gastrophysicist do?
Gastrophysicist is interested in food, in sort of gastronomy, so the nice high end of food, the tasty stuff. But applies the psychology or the psychophysics to try and understand why food tastes as it does to us and what you can do to make it taste better, different, more memorable, more healthy, more stimulating, you name it.
Okay, so then we have to start probably with an example of today. So what kind of food did you eat today already? Breakfast, lunch?
Only breakfast so far. I think I'm a bit late for lunch as I was late for dinner last night. But so yes, but I think maybe breakfast isn't the best time to think about gastrophysics.
Okay, so
something in the morning we don't like to experiment. There's no such thing as molecular gastronomy before lunchtime.
Okay, so okay,
we want comfort food. We want tradition. We want things that we're familiar with that don't challenge us.
Okay, not even if someone is at a hotel. So isn't that like something that we take as a positive outbreak of the daily routine?
You might think so. But in fact, at the start of the day, people's minds, I just think, aren't set in some interesting way. Mm-hmm. That you see all the experimental, all the novel, all the ingenious food, all the gastrophysics research all happens in the evening, maybe at lunchtime, but never before.
Okay, then you said you had dinner last night.
Yep.
Was it a good experience, or was there anything that could have improved the experience for you?
If there had been some food left, that would have been a definite improvement. I got there a bit late, practicing my talk beforehand. But it was a sociable occasion, so company certainly helps make food taste better.
Okay.
There was some music. It was a stand-up dinner. You might think, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Does food taste better when you're sitting down, standing up? These are all kind of questions that we look at.
So what is it then? So I assume that sitting is better for if you want to enjoy your food than standing, is it?
I don't know yet. No one's done the experiment. It's just one of the many things.
But this kind of pop into my mind.
And there are so many such questions, like what if impact does cutlery have? The forks, the knives, the spoons, the glassware that we use to drink with? What effect do those things have on the taste and the enjoyment of food? And yet, no one until 2011 had ever thought about the psychology of the fork.
And is it you who started doing it in 2011?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So then tell me, is it true that plastic cutlery is not so good as like metallic? Probably.
So I think we've done research in the lab, in restaurants, in all over the place. Yeah. What we find is that cutlery really matters, and the heavier the cutlery, the better.
Okay.
So in that reason, you might want to rule out the plastic because it's going to be light. And as we add weight to knives, forks, and spoons, or we add weight to the bowls you're eating from, food tastes better, you're willing to pay more for it, you think it's going to be more filling as well. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of benefits there. Of course, you might not stop just with the weight of the cutlery, but then think about the material and the texture. And we have lots of research looking at furry-handled spoons through to dimpled kind of spoons that kind of, you know, titillate your tongue in whole new ways. It's not just the food, it's a total dining experience, yeah, both on and off the plate.
Okay, but is there any recommendation that you could give, for instance, to a restaurant or so, what they should do to make it a better experience for the customers or for the guests in the restaurant?
So there are some chefs who say, I don't like any of this gastrophysics, this science in the kitchen, this science of food. It's not for me. I like, you know, natural, organic, free range, locally sourced, all that sort of stuff. But then you look at where the restaurants are, and if they're still open and successful, quite often it's in, you know, fancy country houses, and they do have heavy cutlery. Intuitively, okay, They've kind of known some of this stuff.
Yeah.
What we haven't seen yet is, I think, the use of sort of textured cutlery. That is new. Mm-hmm. But probably the single biggest thing, I think, for restaurants and for chefs is to think about the sound or the music in the places in which we eat and drink, because that is something that's kind of easy to change, reasonably easy to control, and yet too often you find chefs who care really passionately about the food that they're serving and haven't let their manager put their iPod on, and you're getting, you know, Bing Crosby singing Merry Christmas in June in an Indian restaurant. It's kind of all wrong in so many ways and so easy to have fixed.
So is it better for an Italian then to really have Italian music, and in a French restaurant, French music, and in a German restaurant?
The beer keller music,
yes.
Of course. It certainly biases the choices we make. Quite dramatically so. We don't think it does. We say, no, I was always going to have a beer tonight or a bottle of French wine. And yet when you change the music from French to German, in the restaurant, in the supermarket and elsewhere, you find patterns of sales shifting.
Yeah.
Everyone's buying the French wine with the French music, and so on. So that's definitely a reason to think carefully about which music you play. And then when I ask you, how authentically German was that beer I was drinking last night? Well, it wasn't German music, I don't think. So it tastes like a nice beer, but not an especially authentically German beer. And again, that's what part of what music brings to the table, as it were.
Okay, so obviously then different senses are involved when it's about taste and how you enjoy your food.
And then maybe we all feel like we taste food and drink in our mouths, that stuff kind of swilling around in there. And yet it's perhaps one of the most multi-sensory things that we do, that we experience, because it does involve smell and sound and sight and touch and pain. All the senses come together. And really, you know, the pleasures of the table, the pleasures of food and drink start in your mind, not in your mouth. Mm-hmm. And that sort of insight that the flavor is a multi-sensory kind of construct is one that is sort of changing the way then that chefs think about their preparation, presentation of food and drink, trying to, you know, deliver, as I start my book, Gastrophysics with, or Gastrologic, as they wanted to call it in Germany, with a kind of a mental palate cleanser. Because, you know, the traditional way for the chef is to cleanse your palate with some acidic sorbet, something that cuts through, I don't know what. But to me, as a gastrophysicist, I think the tongue and the mouth is the least interesting bit of tasting. It's all in the head. If you think like that way, then I want to get you in your mind into the right state of mind. And that's where we see a lot of innovative chefs from Europe and elsewhere, people like Denis Martin, who deliberately try and elevate the mood as soon as the diners come to their very stiff and formal restaurants. And that mental palate cleanser is a very effective way of actually enhancing the tasting experience.
More than the food itself, maybe.
But more than a lime sorbet, I suspect.
Yeah, the lime sorbet. Is that maybe also the reason that people, when they are testing like food or drinks blindfolded, that they might choose like a cheap product over the better product, or not even noticing what is their favorite drink? Mm-hmm. Like even if they have a Coca-Cola, Pepsi, like the blind test, they still would say, oh yeah, the other one is really good as well. Is that the reason for that?
In part, I think we never really put anything in our mouth without looking at it first and thinking about what it might be. Mm-hmm. So our mind already sets flavor expectations. I think I'm going to like it. I think it's good quality. It's sweet. It's nutritious. It's fattening, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And those expectations that come before tasting kind of anchor the tasting experience we have. And when we put something in our mouth, we maybe taste it once, think about it for a moment, say, yep, that's what I thought it was going to be. And then what's my latest message or what's on the TV? So we really live in the world of our expectations as much as we do in our experience of flavor. And for that reason, when you go into a dine in the dark restaurant, when you start doing blind wine tasting or cola tasting, when you take away all those kind of cues that guide expectation, when you're tasting blind, then it's a very different tasting experience. And in those situations, you find, regardless of category, wine, champagne, baked beans, you name it, people cannot pick their favorite brand in the blind taste test. Right. They will discriminate some differences between the products, hopefully, and the one that they like on that occasion, say, that must be my brand, even though it turns out very often not to be. So it's kind of a shocking finding. We've done it in champagne recently, having the champagne book writers who say, you know, the proportion of white and black grapes is really important to the final taste, and then put the champagnes in a black tasting glass, and they cannot pick the most expensive one, and they cannot pick the proportion of different grapes.
So then they need to see the bottle or some other hints.
Yeah. And once you know that, then you can start having lots of fun by miscoloring foods, as it were. So we just came back from Barcelona, where we had 200 sommeliers and others from the wine trade, and gave them a white wine, a glass of rosé wine, and a white wine coloured rosé, because everyone's drinking rosé these days, and asked them, what do they smell? What do they taste? And the more experienced the sommelier or wine expert, the more the red colour in that white wine gave expectations, and hence they could smell and literally taste the red fruits.
Even though it was exactly the same as before.
They didn't smell it when it was a white.
So that also maybe explain why a sommelier would have a look at the wine in the glass and then also decide on how good it is or not.
Yep, because and for the expert, when they see the wine, they can get far more expectations out. They can see how old the wine is, perhaps, whether the summer was hot, so on and so forth, whereas the social drinker says, well, that's white or red, and that's all they get. And the more expectations you build up, the more then the colour can impact you and fool you, if that's what you want.
And you also did some research with the ongoing Brexit that food can help people give security, obviously.
Yeah, you know, so I've been very interested in sort of food trends and seeing which ones sort of fit with kind of the mindset around the senses. On the one hand, we see a lot of stuff about the increasing number of people who want to Instagram their food, and then how does that change the way that food is presented, on the one hand, through to kind of the opposite of Instagrammable food, which is the fondue. And it's kind of, you know, this sort of really ugly pot of bubbling cheese stuff. What's going on there? That's not Instagrammable at all. And yet it is increasingly popular, coming back into fashion in the UK, especially from its previous heyday back in the 60s and the 70s. Yeah. So this has got me sort of thinking, what's going on there? Why has fondue become so popular again in the UK? And I think it's partly maybe, it is sort of a sharing dish. Mm-hmm. Sharing plates are very much in fashion. But more importantly, I think it maybe is the kind of food, sort of links into gastro diplomacy, I want to call, where the kind of foods we eat send messages about the kind of people we are or who we're trying to connect with. And maybe we pick as our favorite food then something from sort of Switzerland.
Yeah.
That kind of has a position relative to Europe that maybe we wish, some of us wish to find ourselves in post Brexit.
So, but in your experiments, you are just checking the differences between different groups, or are you also asking why people are choosing it? So have you asked them directly if it was their connection
The problem for being a gastrophysicist is very often when you ask people why, if I said to you, did you pick up French wine today because of the French music playing, you'll deny it. So yeah, I don't really believe what you say.
Okay.
I look better trust sense. The patterns in the data of actual behavior.
Right.
So it is speculation at this stage, I should say.
Yeah.
But you think it can't just be coincidental that. Yeah. And then that gets you into the whole world of the foods we eat and the signals we send in politics and elsewhere, kind of a much neglected area.
What kind of recommendation would you have, like, to a single person or looking forward to a date, not being a good cook in the kitchen, but still want to prepare a three-course menu? How important is it where you buy the food? Can you go to the Lidl or to some discounter? And is it about presentation? Is it about the feeling? Is it about lightning? Is it about music there as well? What would you do? What would be the perfect date
romantic
situation?
Romantic situation. So we have consulted for a few TV shows on the perfect romantic dinner, how to kind of hack the senses of your date, perhaps your soon-to-be mate, through off-the-plate influences. And that does involve lighting. It does involve music. It does involve the foods you eat. I don't think it matters so much where you buy the foods. Because, again, I think in the blind taste test, if you don't know where things come from, you find it hard to discriminate. Presently, I'm kind of really interested in oysters as a sort of historic food of love and of seduction. Mm-hmm. You see it in paintings from the 16th and 17th century. But why should that food? What is it about it? Is it its visual appearance? Is it its sort of texture that reminds people of something? Or is there some sort of, chemical composition of the oysters that maybe, well, it turns out that there's something special in the oysters. At least Italian bunny rabbits are more fertile on a diet of oysters than on regular rabbit feed. So maybe the same extends to humans. We don't know for sure yet. So it's partly that. I think also lighting is sort of an interesting one. We were told about back in the 70s, the idea was the restaurants should kind of give the impression of kind of, what it was like for caveman and cavewoman. It should be dark. You can't see through the windows, the candles, the fire. And that seems to have very much changed today. I think today it's much more brighter lighting, big windows, and that notion that we should be back in the cave isn't necessarily correct. So in some of our work, what do I do myself? I think it's in gastrophysics or the next book on hacking the senses. I recommend what I always used to do, which was serve hot, spicy food.
Yeah.
And that way, your mate date will start sweating, pupils will dilate, and it's very easy to misinterpret those signals. Wow, they really like me.
Yeah.
I'm feeling so hot and flustered. No one thinks it's the food, they misattribute.
But you're helping.
Yeah.
So that's always good to know then, so that you can influence your date. So obviously what you were describing is that the people change a bit, or maybe tastes change. Not of the food itself, but how we eat and what we think is important. But maybe the gastrophysical point of view is the same all over. Now, talking about everything becoming digitalized nowadays, artificial intelligence, for instance, will that change how we see food, how we take in food, what we are doing with that?
So I'm very interested in this sort of area, interface of technology and food. I think the most interesting things sort of start out in some of the high-end Michelin-starred San Pellegrino-listed restaurants, but will hopefully percolate down to the mainstream or to hospital, to airline food a few years thereafter. And for me, on the one hand, there's kind of amazing stuff coming out of the sort of technology conferences in the Far East, but it is stuff you'd have to buy, and it's expensive and awkward and not very well designed. I'm much more interested in the kind of the ubiquitous technology that's around us, the mobile devices, the tablets, and thinking how can they be repositioned for the food experience, because that technology is there already. You don't have to buy anything, so there's a small cost of entry, and it's very intelligent stuff. So that's driven us into the world of, for example, sonic seasoning on the one hand, which is we find that you can use music to season food.
Right.
Make it sweeter, bring out the bitterness, sourness, whatever you might want. The creamy, spicy for that hot date. We've got some really spicy tracks now. And you can play that over your mobile device, the technology in your pocket, and season food without the calories. So that's one way. And we're currently thinking about, given that many tablets are now waterproof, then presumably you can stick them in your dishwasher. And if you can stick them in your dishwasher, then why not plate off your tablet screen?
Yeah.
And you can see some chefs sort of playing in that space, and we've got reasons why that might be a good idea, because I know that your food will look better if you get the contrast with the plate where just right.
Okay.
And so while often that might be white, it's not always the case. But I don't have a rainbow full of a crockery in my cupboard. Yeah. But if I can change the colour of my screen to match, to bring out the best in the food that's on it, then we've got a functional reason for technology at a table. And so things like that that I think are going to coming online already. For a start, at the very high-end restaurants, but I'm seeing a growing number of brands trying to bringing out sensory apps to enhance the consumer's experience of food and drinks products in the home, built on the science, built on the gastrophysics, but using technology to do so.
But will there ever be any place or any technology that will beat a good dinner at your mum's place?
So they're different. Well, you haven't tried my mother's cooking. But yes, the hypothetical mum's dinner. I think there's certainly different roles that food plays. There is the comfort food.
Yeah.
And people sometimes ask, I don't want to go out to dinner with you. You're going to be criticizing and analyzing all the time. But I say, there is a role for comfort food, and we come back from holiday, say, I was looking forward to my spicy pasta arrabbiata, and that is nothing especially technological or futuristic about it. So that stays there, but I think at the same time, for many of us on an increasing number of occasions, the idea that food can be more than just sustenance, more than just nutrition. I mean, it never was really just that, but it can be theatrical, it can be part of entertainment, it can be combined with what we're listening to, what we are watching in new and interesting ways. That is sort of growing and growing, and it seems that there are more people, not just the millennials, who are sort of interested in that merging of pleasures and experiences. So for us, it's a lot about bringing theatre to the table, or the table into the theatre, and where do you end up as a result, and why are you doing that?
Thank you very much, Charles Spence, for your insights on the gastrophysical. Okay, thank you very much for the talk. Thank you.